One of the other most foundational stories of the Bible outside of the Gospels is the Exodus, the book of Exodus. Both historically and theologically, this book and the story within it are extremely important. We have the birth of Israel, and we have all of these correlations, foreshadowings to Jesus and his life and his sacrifice that happened there. If we're looking at the Old Testament, Exodus is one of the most crucial books to look at in terms of its historicity. And it's also one of the most criticized books in the Old Testament, in the Bible as a whole. If we were to look at what scholars say about it, here are a couple of quotations from two archaeologists. One very well known, and another who has a prominent position. The first one says, "Not only is there no archaeological evidence for such an exodus, there is no need to posit such an event. I regard the historicity of the Exodus as a dead issue." Another says, "The Israelites were never in Egypt, did not wander in the desert. The many Egyptian documents that we have make no mention of the Israelites' presence in Egypt and are also silent about the events of the Exodus." That sums up what the general view of the Exodus is in academia today. Now, there's no consensus in biblical studies or archaeology. There's lots of different views, but the majority would take this position that the Exodus didn't happen, that it's just a myth. And that's what you're going to get if you go into basically any university and you take a class that is talking about the Bible, or a class that is talking about the archaeology of ancient Israel. If they even bring it up, they will say that it's just a myth, it's just a fairy tale, and everyone knows that. Scholars established this a long time ago. And we see what their basic criticisms or allegations are, that there are supposedly no Egyptian texts about the Israelites in Egypt, that there are no ancient Egyptian references to the events of the Exodus, and that there's no archaeological evidence of the events. So what's the difference between those things? Number one is essentially they're saying, of all the different ancient Egyptian writings, none of them mention Israelites as being in Egypt. The second one is that of all the ancient Egyptian writings, none of them talk about or record anything that we could construe as the Exodus event. And then the third one is strictly archaeological. That is, they're saying that there's no evidence from these dig sites, these ancient cities, that any kind of calamity befell Egypt, or that there was plagues, or that there was a destruction of the military, or that there was some revolt against the gods of Egypt, anything like that. But we're going to see that all three of those things and more are not correct. There are a few different problems with the approach to the Exodus as an historical event or an unhistorical event. The first is that these kinds of scholars, they were taught that it's a myth and a fairy tale and it didn't happen, and they were taught that there's no evidence for it. And so that's why they're considering it a dead issue, that we don't even need to look into it anymore because we already figured it out. This is a problem because the absence of archaeological evidence does not indicate that something did not happen or a person did not exist, because the amount of excavation that we've done is a tiny percentage of what's out there. 1% maybe. So new things are always being discovered. So that's a problem. The second is they have these presuppositions, though. They were trained in that way, that the Bible, especially the Old Testament, is essentially religious and political propaganda that was crafted by either the kingdom of Judah or the priests after the Babylonian exile to give themselves sort of this theological and glorious history, even though it's not glorious. And so then they're unwilling to even look into it anymore because this is the position they've taken, not going to bother trying to find something that would make us have to change our minds. The Old Testament, the text of the Old Testament, is a little bit different than what we saw with the Gospels. With the Gospels, I showed you how we have these manuscripts. They're copies that date to within decades or a century of the original manuscripts themselves, the original writings. We don't have that for the Old Testament. Obviously, the Old Testament books were written much, much earlier. And that's really where the main issue comes in, the time. Things get destroyed and decay. If we look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, though, we do have still some fairly early documents, but for Exodus, the 3rd century BC is about the earliest manuscript that we have. That's a lot of time removed in between Moses and the Dead Sea Scrolls. But you know what? Even if we had them from, say, 1400 BC or 1300 BC, we would still see the same criticisms because they would say, all right, fine, so it was written then, but they're just making this up. And so that's why we really have to go and look at the external evidence, as we might call it, from archaeology and other historical sources to see what there is about the Exodus. Now, some of you may have studied this a bit, and you might be aware that there are essentially 3 different views about the Exodus. The first is that it happened, and it happened in the 15th century BC. And we'll go into the reasons for that, but that's essentially a straightforward reading of the biblical text. The second is that it happened, and it happened in the 13th century BC. And there are some variants within this about, ranging from it happened just like it is described in the text versus there's a little bit of history in there. And then the third main one is that it's a myth. That is, it didn't happen at all. It was just a story that was constructed, like we talked about, essentially religious propaganda. Well, the setting for the Exodus is, of course, Egypt, but specifically, it's the northeastern Nile Delta region. And this has a couple of different names in the Bible. It's called the land of Ramses in Genesis 47:11. It's also called the land of Goshen in Exodus 8:22 and elsewhere. There's some other geographical names that we get in there that can help us to situate it. There's Ramses, there's Pithom, there's Heliopolis. Those all come from Exodus 1:11. Later on, there's some kind of fortress. Migdal is the Hebrew word that's usually just shows up in your English translation. Goshen, we talked about. There's Baal Zephon that's mentioned in Exodus 14. There's Pi Hahiroth, and there's the Reed Sea, or what's often you're going to see in your Bible, the Red Sea, but it actually says the Reed Sea in Hebrew. So all of these kinds of things, we can look at these different places and see, did these exist in the time of the Exodus in Egypt? And if so, what was found there? Does it correlate to the Exodus story? Well, first we have to figure out when did the Exodus take place, because they didn't use the BC AD system in ancient times. They went off of things like the year of a particular king or an era of something. And in the case of the Exodus, our key passage for this actually has both an era and the year of a particular king. So 1 Kings 6:1 tells us, in the 480th year after the Israelites came up out of Egypt, in the 4th year of King Solomon's reign over Israel, and then he begins to build the temple. So that's the verse there that gives us all this information. So it's the 4th year of King Solomon's reign. Well, we know when that was because of all the very detailed information we have about the different reign lengths of the Israelite and Judean kings and kings of Assyria and Babylon and Persia and the Greeks and the Romans. All that's put together. Scholars really don't dispute this date for the fourth year of Solomon, about 967 BC. So that's our starting point. Well, then, how do we get to the Exodus? It says it's the 480th year after the Israelites came up out of Egypt, meaning 479 years have elapsed. So they're in the 480th now. We add 479 to this, and we get 1446 BC. It's fairly simple, and yet there are a lot of people who have an issue with this, and they say that this isn't meant to be taken as a literal number. We got to read this like an idiom or figuratively. But there are some reasons why I would say that's not correct. First of all, in Numbers chapter 33, we see dates are talked about here. The year, this year after the Exodus, okay? It talks about in the 40th year after the Israelites came out of Egypt. This is at the end of the wandering period. And you can actually go through and read the books of Moses, and you see oftentimes they're talking about a particular day and a month and a particular year after coming up out of Egypt. And so this is the beginning of a new era when they have left Egypt and they've essentially come together as a nation. They've been given the law. And they continue counting like this. We just don't have every year in it. But the intent seems to be there that these are meant to be taken as actual years in an era numbering system. Now, there's something else very interesting about this. We see that this is the beginning of the temple. And some people have termed this a temple dedication genre. So it's talking about when a temple was built, and it's giving us some dates and some reference point. Well, there are some other texts from different cultures in the ancient Near East that do something similar. So we can look at the way in which they do that. Well, there's one from Assyria in the 1200s BC. It was made by a king named Tukulti-Ninurta. And he talks about how he has repaired and restored the temple of Ishtar in the city of Nineveh. And he talks about how he did that 720 years after this other king who also restored it. Well, if we go back and we look at the reigns of these two kings, we see that they are indeed separated by 720 years. So they're actually giving a real number there and trying to be precise. There's another one in Egypt. It comes from what's called the year 400 stela. And this is talking about the commemoration of a temple of the god Seth by a pharaoh named Seti I. And he says that it was 400 years from this celebration that he had that Seth worship came into this city of Avaris, which I'll explain is it's the same place as Ramses that's talked about in Exodus chapter 1. And if we look at his reign and when he was pharaoh, and then we look at the temple that's actually been excavated there in that city of Avaris and the date that's assigned to it, we see again, it's about 400 years. So they are trying to give real numbers here. It should be read as that, even if we're looking at this in a kind of greater ancient world genre. But there are a couple of other really important passages from the Bible that also can help us to figure this out. One of them is from Judges 11:26, and in this passage, Jephthah is arguing with the sons of Ammon, and they're claiming that there's some land that should be theirs, and so the Israelites should give it back. And he essentially goes through the history of this and says, this isn't your land. The Amorites were here. We defeated them, and we took it over from them. And he says that Israel's been here 300 years. Why didn't you come and take it back during that time or complain about it? All right, so he's saying the Israelites have been settled there in the promised land for 300 years at this point. Now, Jephthah comes late in the Judges period. We don't know exactly when, but he's before Saul a bit. Saul's in 1050 BC. And we can assign generally around 1100 BC for him, okay? And he's saying about 300 years. Well, we add those two together, 1400 BC for the entrance into the Promised Land. We add 40 years for the wandering, and you get about 1440 for the Exodus. So very similar. The next one is from 1 Chronicles 6:33 through 37, and it gives a list of all these generations. And you can see how many generations there are from the time of the Exodus until the time of Solomon. And basically there are 19 generations. We could say there are 18 generations, and then there's the end of one and the beginning of another. All right? Now, generations in the ancient world, they're somewhere in between 22 to 28 years. You know, that's generally what a generation would be in terms of someone having a son, and then their son has a son. Well, if we just kind of put in the middle of that time, say 25 years, and multiply that by 19 generations, that gives us 475 years in between Solomon and the Exodus, which is almost exactly what we saw. And finally, if we go to the book of Acts, Luke talks about this a little bit, and he records that there was this 450-year time period up until the time of Solomon. So that verse, it's a little confusing, but the main point that I want to make with that is that it shows this longer period of time. Okay, it doesn't show, for example, 200-something years. So that's how we arrive at the chronology. Now, where is that in Egyptian history? Well, if we correlate that date to Egyptian history, this 1446 BC, we come into what's called the 18th dynasty of Egypt. Egypt is divided up into these pharaonic dynasties. And it actually falls into the reign of a king named Amenhotep II, which we will look at in a bit. But going back to the beginning of the Exodus period, well, what happens before all of this? The Israelites, they come over into Egypt from Canaan. And they're not a nation at this time. It's just a family. It's the sons of Jacob. It's Jacob and his sons and their sons. So there's a migration, and they start out small, about 70 people. And then over the centuries, they grow larger and larger and larger. And when we go to this northeastern Nile Delta part of Egypt, and we look at some of these archaeological sites, the cities that are specifically mentioned in the text of Exodus, like Ramses or like Pithom or Heliopolis, is one that's mentioned in the Septuagint, we see that there were indeed people who had come over from Canaan in this pre-Exodus period. And they had their own specific culture. They had different types of pottery and different types of weapons, and they buried their dead differently, and they raised sheep. There's even a specific variety of sheep, a long-haired sheep that comes from Canaan that was brought over to this area of Egypt. The Egyptians, they talk about this, and they show it on some of their artwork. This is a tomb painting from the tomb of Khnumhotep II. It shows a group of people from Canaan migrating into Egypt, and there's a big, long line of them, actually. This is just one little small part, but they bring their animals, and they bring their wives and their children, and one of the guys you can see on there in the middle actually has a multicolored coat on, sort of like the one that is described for Joseph. On the right, you see that weird-looking mushroom head thing. So this is a statue. It's an Egyptian statue that was found in the city of Ramses. Okay, Avaris is an earlier name for that city. And it was a person like Joseph in that their family had come from Canaan, but they were living in Egypt, and they became an official in the Egyptian government. They achieved some high position in the Egyptian government. Why that's important is because this is not something that was just happening regularly during Egyptian history. There was a specific period in time when that was common. Other times of Egyptian history, it was very uncommon or even impossible, essentially. Because later on, The Egyptians actually enslaved a lot of these people, not just Israelites, anybody who came from Western Asia. So that gives us some basic context there. An important Egyptian inscription comes from this pharaoh queen named Hatshepsut, who's a very interesting character. This is prior to the Exodus, but she talks about some rebuilding and restoration that she does. And she says, back in the time when the Asiatics, that's the term that the Egyptians use for people from Canaan, were in the midst of the delta, so she's saying they're in this northeastern Nile, this Nile Delta region, in Avaris, that's the name of the city. Like I said, it's the same city as Ramses. It had different names over time. And then she says that there are these vagrants or maybe shepherds who are also living there. And she says they ruled without the sun. All right, that means they didn't worship the sun god, Ra. So they had some different religious beliefs. Now, this could be talking about just Canaanites who didn't worship Ra and who were shepherds, but it also fits the Israelites quite well. We see in Genesis 46 that Joseph advises his family to tell the Pharaoh that they are shepherds because the Egyptians didn't like shepherds. They didn't like sheep. They didn't raise them. And this would allow them to have their own space and be shepherds there. We have a lot of evidence of people raising sheep in this area in the pre-Exodus and Exodus time period. But we also have some interesting names that are found. So at this same city, this Avaris or Ramses, 9 of these little scarab seals, that's one up there, have been found. So a scarab is it's a type of beetle, but the Egyptians made these into little amulets or ring seals, and then they would inscribe something often on the flat side of them. And sometimes this is the name of a pharaoh, other times it's some dedication to a god or an official's name. This is probably some type of official, although some people are of the opinion that it was a king. Anyhow, the name there is Jacob El. So it's showing us that the name Jacob was in use during the time of the patriarchs, during the time of Jacob and Joseph, actually, in Egypt, in this northeastern Nile Delta region. Now, we can't say that this is an inscription mentioning Jacob of the Bible. Maybe it is, but probably it's not. He doesn't seem to have had a government position. But it does tell us that this is the correct time period and location for that type of name. And there are lots of instances of this in what we might call the patriarchal period. You know, with the name Abraham, for example, that's been found in southern Mesopotamia near Ur in 1900 BC. Things like that. It fits. It fits the context. You know, it's not a name that was used in 500 BC in Babylon. Okay. But this tells us that there were people with those kinds of names that we see in the Bible, the Israelites, the Hebrews, living there in this northeastern Nile Delta region. Another one is the name Jesse appears in this time just before the Exodus in southern Egypt. But there's a very important Egyptian papyrus called Papyrus Brooklyn. And it's kind of a mundane papyrus when you think of it in broad terms. It's not some interesting, exciting story. It's just a list of servants. But I think it's incredibly important in terms of looking at the Exodus evidence. And that's because within this list, we have a bunch of names classed as Semitic. Okay, so Semitic names, that includes Hebrew, Canaanite, some of these other similar languages. Now, within those Semitic names, we even see what we could call biblical Hebrew names. That is, names that appear in the Bible for people that are Hebrews. Some of these are feminine versions of male or masculine names that we're used to in the Bible. And the reason for that is that this is a list of household servants. So most of the household servants were females. most of the servants or the slaves that were working in the fields or doing building projects were men. But we have names like Menahemah and Asherah, Shiphrah, okay? Shiphrah appears in Exodus 1:15. Akobah, like Jacob, Sekerah, Dawidi, okay, like David, Esebto, which means herb in Hebrew. It's not actually found as a name in the Bible, but the word is found in Deuteronomy, for example. Chaya, which is Eve, and then the name Hebrew also. So this seems to be attesting that there were people with Hebrew names living in Egypt prior to the Exodus, and actually as servants too. Really are kind of around the time of Joseph or just after him. So that, I would say, that's our first written evidence of Hebrew people living in Egypt prior to the Exodus. And that kind of solves the issue, or at least puts a big question mark for those who would say there's no evidence that Hebrews or Israelites were living in Egypt before the Exodus. Well, as you read the first chapter of Exodus, you see in verse 8 that it says, "Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph." And this is the one then who starts the enslavement. Who is this? Well, it doesn't name him, but the way that it talks about it, a new king arose. He didn't know Joseph. He started the enslavement. And it's in the 18th dynasty is when the Exodus happened. So we have a lot of clues, and we can narrow it down really to only one option, and that seems to be a pharaoh whose name was Amos the First. So Amos the First, he was king in southern Egypt. So a little bit before the Exodus, Egypt was divided into north and south. There were some Semitic rulers in the north, there were native Egyptian rulers in the south. Well, the Egyptians were trying to get their whole country back. So they attacked the north, and they were finally successful. This guy, Amos the First, took over northern Egypt again. And so he establishes a new dynasty, the 18th dynasty. And of course, he wouldn't know anything about Joseph because his line wasn't at all connected to Joseph or the kings that Joseph was connected to, a totally different dynasty. And then what does this guy do? He starts this policy of mass enslavement for Asiatics, for people from Western Asia or Canaan. And we see this throughout Egyptian records. Now, they don't specify tribal names, so they're not talking about Israelites or Jebusites or anything like that. They just group them all into one lump of Asiatics. But that is really consistent with what we know from Egyptian history. And then a bit after that, we have the birth of Moses in about 1526 BC, if we're going by the biblical numbers that says Moses was gone or left Egypt when he was 40, and then he came back 40 years later, so he's 80 at the Exodus. Well, around that time that Moses is born, we see he's put into a basket, goes down the Nile River, and it says that he is seen by the daughter of Pharaoh. And she rescues him or orders him to be rescued. Well, why would she be there on the river? Well, the city at that time, Avaris, that is also called or later called Ramses, there was a royal palace that had been built there right on the river. And this palace has actually been excavated. So we know a bit about its architecture and when people lived there and then when the Pharaoh abandoned it. So it makes a lot of sense that the daughter of Pharaoh would be right there bathing on the river because the palace is right there also. But we might even be able to identify who this daughter of Pharaoh was. I think it's Hatshepsut, who we looked at earlier briefly. Why is that? Well, the timing lines up, the chronology lines up, but also she's the only daughter of the Pharaoh at that time who survived past infancy. So she's really the only candidate. But there's something even more interesting. So she raises Moses, right? She adopts him. She raises him in the royal household. Something very strange happens later on, after the time of the Exodus, later in the reign of the Exodus Pharaoh, is that he starts to destroy her monuments. He breaks her statues. He erases the pictures of her. He chips out her name on all these monuments and puts his name over that, as if she did something horrible to offend the gods of Egypt or broke the system of Egypt. And this is recognized by Egyptologists, but they don't know what the explanation is. They think, you know, she must have done something. Maybe it's just because she was a female pharaoh, and that was not normal. But if she was the one who raised Moses, saved him and raised him, then it would be understandable that the Pharaoh of the Exodus would partially blame her for that. It was a consequence of her saving him that all this havoc then came to Egypt, and so he tried to erase her memory. Akhenaten is another one whose memory the Egyptians tried to erase after his time. You may have heard of him. He's the one who changed the religious system of Egypt temporarily. So this happened sometimes, but it was always a very big thing that they did in order to have this penalty put upon them later, you know, after their reign. Well, in the city of Avaris here, we have some very, very interesting findings from the excavations. So besides that palace that was discovered, and the book of Exodus tells us that the Pharaoh's palace was there in Ramses on the river, they also found these huge storage facilities that were built. Well, Exodus 1:11 tells us that the Israelites were forced to build these storage cities at Ramses and Pithom, and then the Septuagint version also says Heliopolis. So they found storage facilities, huge grain silos in this palace complex area in the city of Ramses from the time of Moses and the time before the Exodus. There also are this interesting abandonment of that palace complex. It's abandoned sometime during the reign of Amenhotep II, Pharaoh Amenhotep II, who I think we can identify as the Pharaoh of the Exodus. Well, if all these plagues happen, all this destruction happened, it would make sense that they might leave that palace and move to a different part of Egypt. And in fact, the excavators, they're not sure why it was abandoned, but one of the reasons, or the main speculation they have, is there was some kind of plague that caused this. Well, one of the other cities, Pithom, that's mentioned, we think we have this located. There are a couple different possibilities, but this one seems like the best one in terms of lining up with the archaeological evidence. This one also had storage facilities that were built in this pre-Exodus period, this time of Moses and before. And then the town is abandoned during the reign of Amenhotep II. Seems very odd. It seems like something has happened, something that has collapsed part of Egypt, and all these people are leaving and they're going elsewhere. Heliopolis, the third city that's mentioned. We don't know about storage facilities there, but we do know that there was a lot of building done there in this pre-Exodus period, earlier in Moses' life. Because of the inscriptions of this pharaoh, Thutmose III, so he's the one that came before the Exodus. And he had all this extra building done there. All right, so maybe that was part of it, maybe it wasn't. But the other two sites have some very interesting correlations. There are Egyptian texts about slave labor. There's Egyptian artwork about it. This one, I think, is very good at illustrating some of the things that the Israelites were involved in. The making of mud bricks and then building of buildings. This is showing on the tomb, the wall of the tomb of, his name was Rekhmirah, who was in power during the enslavement period, prior to the Exodus and then actually through that, it shows Semitic slaves making bricks and building buildings. And there's an Egyptian text from a little bit after this time that talks about the same situation of the quota of bricks that is discussed in Exodus chapter 5. And it's the same situation where we have these people, they're supposed to make a certain amount of bricks, but they're not given the required amount of straw to make them anymore. So they needed that to help them bind together so they wouldn't just fall apart. And as a result, they're not able to make their required quota, and they get beat for it. So same situation, same context that we're seeing here in Egypt during this period. What about the plagues themselves? Now, we wouldn't expect the Egyptians to necessarily talk a lot about the Exodus. It would be embarrassing for them, and it wasn't what these ancient cultures did in their official documents. The kings did not preserve their failures in their official documents. They only talked about their victories, and they tried to spin everything to make themselves look good and in the best light. A great example of this that more people will be familiar with is when Sennacherib besieged Jerusalem during the time of Hezekiah. And the Bible tells us that he failed. The angel of the Lord went out and killed all his officers and mighty warriors, and then he goes back to Nineveh. Well, you can read the Assyrian account of that whole campaign, and every detail matches up until that point. He besieges Jerusalem, he talks about that, he talks about Hezekiah, he talks about the tribute, and then it's done, it's over. There's nothing about him taking Jerusalem, there's nothing about him losing his men, it's over. And then we see in some other Assyrian texts he's back in Nineveh. So they just leave out the bad parts. However, there is an Egyptian poem that might be talking about the time of the plagues. This is popularly called the Ippur Papyrus, but it's a lamentation work. It's a poetic lamentation, kind of like the Book of Lamentations that Jeremiah did. Or there's some earlier ones, the lament for Ur, the city of Ur, where Abraham was from. When it got destroyed, someone wrote a lamentation about that. So it was a genre in the ancient world. It's a poem, so it's going to be different than a historical narrative, but it can still contain some helpful information. And the author is basically complaining to the chief Egyptian god, who at the time was Ra or Amun-Ra, and he's also complaining about the Pharaoh. They're not helping. They're not doing what they're supposed to. They're not preserving the land of Egypt. And there are all these correlations that we can see with the Exodus and the Exodus plagues. The most obvious one is it talks about the river is blood. The Nile River is blood, and blood is everywhere throughout the land of Egypt. So that line or that note kind of set some people off to wondering, is this maybe talking about the Exodus? Maybe it's just a coincidence, right? But when you look at all these other things, it gets less and less likely that it's a coincidence. So there's talk about the destruction of the land, plague and pestilence, the death of livestock. People have some kind of problem. We don't know exactly what it is, but it talks about their hair has fallen out and they're in such pain that they wish they could die. To me, this sounds a bit like the boils. The plants are destroyed, trees are destroyed, grain is destroyed. There's a line about how day does not dawn on the land of Egypt and the power of Ra, the sun god, is not seen. So that sounds a bit like the days of darkness. And generally they talk about the gods of Egypt are absent or they're powerless. And if we go to the book of Numbers, for example, it talks about how the plagues actually showed that the gods of Egypt were powerless and God, Yahweh, was the one true God. Children of different classes died and so forth. And then finally, these servants take and wear gold, silver, and precious stones like the Israelites did right before they departed. So there are a lot of really interesting correlations The death of the firstborn might be alluded to in this Egyptian stele. So this guy, Thutmose IV, he's the son and the successor pharaoh of Amenhotep II, who I'm arguing is the Exodus pharaoh. And he put this story on the stele that was between the paws of the Sphinx. And in it, he talks about how one day he was out hunting, and he goes there and he takes a nap, and the god of the Sphinx comes and talks to him and says, "Hey, if you clear this sand away, then I'll make you a deal, and you'll be the pharaoh." And so he's essentially created this divine blessing, propaganda, that all along the gods had this plan that he would become the pharaoh. Now, why would he do that? Well, he actually had an older brother who was supposed to become the pharaoh, but this older brother died. We don't have an explanation for it in the Egyptian sources, but if that's the firstborn in the plague, then that's how he died. It's a very strange and unique text there in Egyptian history. Well, there are other interesting correlations, like there's the decline of the military after this, and as I said, the palace was abandoned. There's even a slave raid in Canaan that this pharaoh goes and does. Seems like it's about a year after the Exodus, actually, and he claims to take 100,000 prisoners for slaves, plus a bunch of weapons and chariots. Sounds like maybe they needed some more slaves replenished, and they needed to get chariots back they might have lost in the sea. There is actually an Egyptian text, though, that does talk about the Exodus. It's just much later. And it's from a priest and historian of Egypt called Manetho. So he lived in the 4th and 3rd century BC. So he's quite distant from the Exodus time, but he has access to records that we don't, that no longer exist. So their temples were kind of their repositories of knowledge. And he actually talks about kind of two different Exoduses. The first one seems to be the expulsion of these people we call the Hyksos. But then the second one is the Israelites. And it says they go to Jerusalem, and he connects them to Judea. So we know who it is. But he also names the pharaoh associated with that Exodus. And he says that that pharaoh's name is Amenhotep. So it seems like he is confirming to us not only that an Exodus happened and that Egyptians at least at some point knew about it, but that the pharaoh's name was Amenhotep. Finally, the last thing I think is important in this whole argument is that, what about the wandering? Well, there's not much evidence, really, the physical evidence in Sinai, because they were nomads. But it's very interesting that the Egyptians themselves actually refer to a group of people called the nomads of Yahweh as living in this Sinai type of area east of Egypt some decades after the Exodus. So this would either be right at the end of the wandering period, or maybe it would be the beginning of the conquest, but they were nomads at both times. Well, this is the earliest time that the name Yahweh is ever found in any kind of inscription. And it's on an Egyptian temple that was made for this pharaoh. And so what's that telling us? It tells us that the Egyptians actually knew the name Yahweh, and they knew about these people who were, at that time, nomads, who were associated with Yahweh. This seems to be then the Israelites. The Israelites are the only people in the ancient world who were ever associated with Yahweh, that ever worshipped Yahweh. We can go back and look at all the inscriptions, all the texts. No other cultures had Yahweh as their god. So this is essentially restricted to being the Israelites. And they're placed in the place that they're supposed to be geographically and living the way they're supposed to be as nomads and associated with Yahweh. And of course, how did the Egyptians know about them? Well, they must have had some kind of interaction with them. That seems like what we've been looking at, that the Israelites actually lived in Egypt, and there was this Exodus event, and now they are gone and living as nomads before they eventually settle in the land of Canaan. And that's essentially the argument for the Exodus, is that we have Hebrews living in Egypt prior to the time of the Exodus. These cities that are mentioned, they've been found, and there's, you know, the palace, there are these storage facilities, there's the abandonment of those places, there's this possible Egyptian poetic account of the plagues, there's this Exodus Pharaoh who has a lot of different circumstantial evidences that line up, and there's this defacement of Hatshepsut, who could have been associated with Moses. And then finally, the Egyptians, they know about Yahweh, and they know about these wanderers associated with Yahweh. And right after that is when we start to see the settlement of the Israelites in Canaan. So they were in place A at time one, and then they show up in place B at time two, and there's some very interesting correlations that are happening to different aspects of this story. So rather than no evidence whatsoever, we have quite a bit. It's not as an open and shut of a case as we might like, but again, very, very little has actually been excavated and published. So I think that over time, more and more will continue to be discovered and make this even clearer than it is already. So that will wrap up this for tonight, and so we're going to have a Q&A session. Any question that you have about the archaeology of Jesus or the Exodus or even some other biblical archaeology things, I'll be happy to try to answer.
Yeah, so if you just raise your hand if you have a question about anything he's talked about or archaeological stuff in the Bible, I'll bring the microphone to you and you can ask. If you do have kids in childcare and you are going to ask a question, raise your hand here quickly, because we're going to dismiss the parents in 10 minutes who are using childcare. So keep that in mind, all right?
You mentioned the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and several of us that have been to Israel have also been shown the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, as well as Gordon's Calvary or the Garden Tomb. How do you feel between those two places?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the tomb of Jesus, where is that located? So there are actually three places that are claimed for this. There's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, that's the traditional location. There is the Garden Tomb, which is connected to Gordon's Calvary. And then there's the Family Tomb of Jesus. So of those three, only the Church of the Holy Sepulchre has any kind of ancient tradition or association. Now, the Family Tomb of Jesus is the one where they found some ossuaries with names that are found in the Gospels, and they tried to create this whole story about, oh, Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene, and these are his kids. And so, you know, there's no evidence for that, and even pretty much every secular scholar rejects that too. But as far as the Garden Tomb, now, the tomb and the Garden Tomb was actually carved in the 7th or the 8th century BC, so the time of Hezekiah. And it's not a single chamber tomb like the tomb of Jesus in the Gospels. It's a double chamber tomb. So it's the wrong time. It's the wrong type of tomb. And as far as the sort of the Calvary place, Gordon's Calvary, when he went to Jerusalem, this guy was looking around and trying to figure out some of the ancient locations in the city, and he saw this rock face, and it looked like the face of a skull to him. And so he thought, oh, maybe this is Golgotha. But the problem is that Golgotha in the Gospels is described as a cranium. So it's a round hill, the top of your head, like that. It's not the face of the skull. And further, that was probably carved out in what's called the Ottoman period, which lasted from about the 16th century AD until World War I. So there's no evidence at all. I mean, the evidence is all against the Garden Tomb, and I can't think of one archaeologist who thinks that's the tomb of Jesus. I don't think the Garden Tomb people even claim that. They just say it's a good place to come because it does illustrate well. You go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, you can't see a garden, right? It's very difficult to visualize that. So But if you go, you look at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and you look at the history there, there are Christian historians back in the 300s AD who are writing about that as the tomb of Jesus. And they've derived their information from earlier sources. And what happened is that area was originally a quarry back in, say, the time of the Kingdom of Israel, or maybe the Hellenistic period, time of Alexander the Great and later, right? In the first century BC, it got turned into a garden area. And then they started using it as a cemetery also. So it was outside of the city at the time of Jesus. But about 11 years after Jesus, they built another wall that enclosed a bigger area of the city. And so later on, it got enclosed. And that's actually what confused some of the early explorers, is they weren't sure where the limits of the city were. So it got turned into a cemetery. And you can actually see some of the other first century tombs in the church. There's one called the Tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. It's, you know, not his tomb probably, but it's a first century tomb. When you look at the tomb of Jesus, it's all dressed up now, right? But they did some restoration recently with National Geographic, and they actually removed part of it, and you could see the original limestone carved burial bench where the body would have lain. It is a single chamber tomb. It's actually the only single chamber rock-carved tomb in all of Jerusalem from that period. It's very unique. So like I talked about before, these other tombs, they were family tombs. So they all had multiple chambers. Now, the Christians knew where Jesus was buried and where he was resurrected, and they continued to live in Jerusalem. And in the second century, about 130 AD, there was an emperor named Hadrian who was trying to get rid of Christianity. And he had seen some of the earlier attempts by Roman emperors who just tried to persecute or kill Christians. And he saw that that didn't work. So he had some different strategies. He was a philosopher kind of guy. He loved the Greeks. And so at first he thought, I'm going to have an argument with the Christians and I'm going to convince them that their beliefs are wrong. Well, he attempted that and it didn't work. So then his next objective or his next strategy seemed to be to try to erase the historical memory of Christianity or to merge it with Roman beliefs. And so he began building Roman temples over all these locations that were connected to the life of Jesus. He built a shrine to Adonis over the cave where Jesus was born. He built a massive double temple to Jupiter and Venus over the tomb of Jesus and the possible crucifixion site right next to it. He built a temple to Asclepius, the god of healing, over the pool of Bethesda, and he seems to have built a shrine to the nymphs over the pool of Siloam. And so this is something that we can see the archaeological evidence for, as well as early historical sources talking about it. But in doing that, he actually helped preserve the memory of those locations, because when Constantine's mother got to Jerusalem, along with their architect, they went and they talked to the bishop of Jerusalem, and they said, you know, where did these things happen? And they said, it's right here. You know, this one's under this Roman temple, this one's under this Roman shrine. And so they removed that temple, and there was this tomb underneath it, this single chamber stone tomb. Now, it doesn't look the same today because they modified some of it. They actually cut around it so that they could build a building around the tomb itself and protect it. So it doesn't look like it's carved into this rock cliff face like it used to be, but the core of the tomb is still there. In fact, you can enter into it today and you go through the old doorway. It's just, as I said, it's all dressed up, so it's hard to visualize. But we have the ancient sources that talk about it. We have the Christian memory and tradition of it. We have the attempted destruction of it by the Romans, and we have the archaeological material that gives us some additional info. So, you know, I would say with more than 99% certainty that the one in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is the tomb of Jesus.
All right. All right, hey, just in case this question goes long, if you've got kids in the childcare, if you do us a favor and go grab your kids, and maybe you can hop out here and catch the rest of the questions, but we want to let those childcare workers go.
So have you gotten to see any of the artifacts that were uncovered under the Red Sea that they were looking at, thinking that that might be where the army was drowned? You know anything about
Yeah,
that?
There's not any artifacts that? Like that. So that was all basically, some of it was kind of a hoax, others was a misunderstanding. So there's a type of coral that is throughout the Red Sea that grows up off of a root sort of, and then it branches out into this circular formation. So some people were diving and looking at that, and they were thinking, that kind of looks like a chariot wheel on an axle, and maybe this coral grew over it. The problem is that's a species of coral that's found all over the Red Sea. You may have seen some picture of a thing that kind of looks like a wheel, but it's not an Egyptian chariot wheel from the Exodus time. It's not an Egyptian chariot wheel from any time. And that wouldn't just be sitting on the surface of the sand either from 3,400 years ago. And it's also not where the crossing would have occurred either. So we haven't found the remnants of Pharaoh's army. Can we find that? It's possible, but it would be very difficult because you would have to know really exactly where to look and then dig down there, and you would have to find some kind of material that had not decayed over 3,400 years. And the wood, which most of them were made primarily out of wood, that would be gone because there was water first, right? Even if it's sand now, it was water first. Metal would rust. If it's iron, even bronze would have some issues. If there's gold or gold mixed with silver, some of the fancier chariots would have had that. That would stay. So there could be a little bit, but we would have to know exactly where to look.
Dr. Kennedy, I appreciate greatly your message and all your information. You're a young man. Can you yourself read these inscript all these old pap of these things you've showed us?
Yes, yes. Yeah, I had courses in Hebrew and Greek and Egyptian hieroglyphs and Akkadian and some other things. So I can still read the hieroglyphs. The Akkadian is difficult if you don't practice it much, but some of the Hebrew and Phoenician inscriptions, that's not a problem, the Greek and so forth. Yeah, I might look young, but I've been doing archaeology for a while. My first excavation was 22 years ago, and I've been involved in excavation or archaeological projects at 17 sites in 5 different countries, including directing four of my own projects and starting a 5th one soon. So I've had some experience in the field.
Do I look young too? just wanna ask.
You mentioned this morning that Jesus was maybe born 7 BC. And then I noticed tonight you had put the triumphal entry at 33 AD. So how does that work as far as his age?
Mm-hmm. Good question. All right. So the book of Luke is where we have that passage about his approximate age, right? And that is in reference to when he began his ministry, which it says in the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar. So we know from Roman records that the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar was about 28 AD. That's when it started anyway. So they didn't, his reign and our years don't exactly line up month to month. But all right, so then if Jesus was born at the end of December in 7 BC and his crucifixion is in the spring of 33 AD, then Yeah, he might be like 39 years old when it comes to that. But when he started his ministry, that was about 5 years previous. So maybe he's about 34 years old at the beginning of his ministry. Luke just says he was about 30 years of age. So it's rough. Maybe it's not as perfect as we want it to be. Maybe it would have been nicer if Luke would have said he was 32 years old, but he didn't give us that kind of detail. So as far as 33 being the date of the crucifixion, that is a lot more solid than, say, 7 BC for the birth. Like I talked about this morning, we kind of have parameters for the birth, and we can't say definitively it was such and such a year. That seems like the most likely scenario. But as far as the crucifixion, we're lining up things like, first of all, the ministry of Jesus starting in the 15th year of Tiberius, right? Okay. Then we have four different Passovers that are mentioned in the book of John. So it has to be at least 4 years, but it seems like there's a fifth, because 32, there Passover was not on a... did not start on a Friday in that year. So there's basically 30 AD and 33 AD fit with some of the evidence. It could be either one of those. But with the additional things like the length of his ministry and possibly this issue I talked about with Sejanus, that has pushed almost to a consensus now for scholars that 33 AD was the date of the crucifixion. It seems very solid, so.
All right, we'll do one more with Ken in the back, and then I'll pray, and then you guys can stay and talk, but we'll dismiss after this one.
The easy question is, do you have a piece of Noah's Ark?
I do not.
Okay.
The only piece of Noah's Ark that I know of that's in a museum, and I'm not saying it actually is a piece of Noah's Ark, but in Armenia, there's this old museum from the Orthodox Church there, and they have a piece of petrified wood that a monk in the 4th century went up to Ararat and retrieved, and then he said it was a piece of the Ark. So we can't verify that, but okay. It's interesting nonetheless.
A gentleman named Erastus is mentioned in Paul's writings in the book
yes.
of Acts. An inscription was found in Corinth in 1929, but it uses a title different for Erastus than the one used in Romans 16. Do you think this is the same Erastus?
It is the same Erastus, and it's equivalent. The title is equivalent. So on the inscription, it's Latin, but in the book of Romans, it's Greek. So it's the city treasurer. It's the same thing.
There you have it. All right. Well, everybody, thanks for coming out. We hope to do more of these in the future, different speakers, different authors, different specialties and fields and things like that, be it scientific or philosophy or history. There's all kinds of fantastic resources out there that God has blessed his church with. So I hope to do more of these in the future. I'm going to pray, and then are you going to hang out here or go out in the foyer? What do you want to do?
I'll go out there.
Okay. Okay, and we only have 2 books left out there, so go. No. yeah, that's right. Oh, there's only 1 left now. So, no, she's selling them. So, all right. Lord, thank you so much for this time together tonight, and just grateful for the gifts that you give us and the blessings you give your people, how you encourage our faith, and Lord, I love the experiential side of our faith, and that's something wonderful, the relationship we have with you. But we also have these just concrete evidences here that you've given us that verify the word and verify these things that we cling to so dearly. And so we're grateful for that. I pray that people would leave tonight encouraged that we have a no-so salvation. We have a God who is there, who loves us, and who blesses us in so many ways. We're thankful for Titus and him sharing with us, Lord. Bless these people tonight, we pray. In your name, amen.